Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
It's Friday, May the 4th. Hello and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And I'm Zipora Nyambura in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on today's show, Mozambique's peace process in limbo following the unexpected death of RENAMO rebel leader Afonso Lacama.
The clamour was really RENAMO, and it was built around the big man himself. RENAMO will now have to reach a consensus on who should succeed him, and that's by no means an easy task.
And Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa launches the party's new manifesto ahead of elections.
You cannot force people to vote for you, but we can persuade people to vote for us.
Plus, Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas wraps his visit to Ethiopia and Tanzania. We shall be hearing what was top on the agenda of that visit.
But before that, let's give this time for a look at other headlines around the world.
I'm Eddie Micah Jr. with DW News. The Prime Minister of Chad and his entire government have resigned amid controversial constitutional changes in a move that strengthens the powers of President Idriss Deby. A full presidential regime without Prime Minister or Vice President was approved by lawmakers on Monday. The head of state was due to sign them into law on Friday. The constitutional changes come despite opposition warnings that they would undermine democracy. President Deby has been in power for over two decades in the oil-rich African state, and the changes will increase the presidential terms from 5 to 6 years with a limit of 2 terms. The current mandate is 5 years with no limits on re-election. Chad is ranked by Transparency International as one of the world's most corrupt nations. As part of a trip to Africa, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas on Friday commemorated African victims of World War I at a memorial ceremony in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. He laid a wreath for the Askari, the African fighters who fought as part of the German army against British, Belgian and Portuguese troops. Thousands of them lost their lives. Prior to that, Maas paid a visit to the African Union in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. He assured the AU's 55 member states that Germany remains committed to expanding cooperation, especially in the areas of security and economy. It is the minister's first Africa trip, 7 weeks after taking office, ahead of visits to Asia, South America, and Australia. For the first time in almost 70 years, the Nobel Prize in Literature will not be awarded this year by the Swedish Academy. This follows sex abuse allegations that have tarnished the award's public image. The Academy's permanent secretary, Anders Olsen, made this statement.
We have decided not to award a prize this year, and we did that after long and intense discussions. But we reached the conclusion that the confidence in the Academy is so low in the world at the moment, and that is the deciding reason why we now refrain from awarding the prize.
The literature prize is worth 9 million Swedish kronas, that's about 1.1 million US dollars. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says two Congolese refugee children have been killed in a bus accident in southwestern Uganda. 34 others were injured when 837 refugees were moving from a transit center in a convoy of 11 buses. The accident occurred when one of the buses carrying 76 passengers veered off the road in the district of Ibanda and overturned. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Nearly 1,500 residents have been evacuated from their homes after Hawaii's Kilauea volcano erupted, sending molten lava through forest land and paved streets. Officials could not immediately predict how long the eruption might last. Hawaii's governor activated the National Guard to help with evacuations and provide security to hundreds of structures left unoccupied after residents fled. By Friday afternoon, there were no reports of injuries. The eruption comes after days of earthquakes rattled the area's Puna district. An earthquake measuring 5 on the Richter scale was recorded hours before the eruption began. And in sports news, Scottish club Rangers have named former Liverpool and England midfielder Steven Gerrard as new manager in a 4-year deal. Gerrard, who replaces Graham Murty, will now vacate his role at Anfield as youth coach. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
Welcome back to the program. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakide. Remember, we are live on Facebook, so do join us there. And let's have a dialogue about the stories we are covering.
Right, let's begin in Mozambique, where the nation is still shocked by the sudden death of RENAMO leader Afonso Lacama. On hearing the news of Lacama's death, President Filipe Nyusi said the country's fragile peace process must not collapse as a result. For nearly four decades, Lacama led RENAMO, the rebel group, which fought a 16-year civil war against the ruling Frelimo Party until 1992.
And though RENAMO is now an opposition party, it has still retained some of its armed fighters. Alex Vines is head of Africa program at Chatham House in London. Earlier on, he told me why the president and many observers like him are now concerned about Mozambique's peace process.
This peace process that's been underway in Mozambique since late December 2016 was getting very close to an agreement. I expected an agreement between President Nyusi and the late Afonso Lacama to have occurred within the next 6 to 8 weeks. It was a ripe moment for an agreement, but this is now jeopardized by the unexpected death of Mr. Lacama. And the danger is that from the RENAMO side, much of the decision making and signing off on the agreement was personalized in Lacama himself, and he hadn't really devolved any authority to anybody else.
So much of the RENAMO party revolved around Lacama. That's what you're saying. What happens to the party now?
Lacama was really RENAMO, and it was built around the big man himself, and there had been no succession planning. So, well, we'll see. RENAMO will now have to reach a consensus on who should succeed him. And that's by no means an easy task. There are different factions in RENAMO which had been kept under control by Lacama, and we'll now have to see how they reach consensus. It's urgent not only for the Mozambican peace process, which is close to conclusion, but RENAMO will be facing municipal elections in October this year, and there are national elections in Mozambique and presidential elections next year, and so RENAMO will need to try and unite around a new leader.
In the upcoming elections in 2019, what chances does RENAMO now have following the death of their leader, Lacama?
RENAMO's politics was certainly very personalized, but there is deep frustration at the track record of the dominant party in government, Frelimo. A by-election in Ampula earlier this year showed that. And so Mozambican voters are certainly not impressed by the Frelimo track record in terms of reducing poverty and inequality. And so voters are looking for alternatives. But this will certainly have damaged RENAMO by losing Lacama, because Lacama had tapped in to a frustrated electorate that wanted to see greater political pluralism in Mozambique.
Alex Vines, head of Africa programs at Chatham House in London.
And Crispin, we did ask on our Facebook, don't you think rebel groups in Africa should follow his footstep to bring peace in the continent? And one WhatsApp user from Italy says, it depends what you call rebel groups. If they are rebels because a dictator called them so, know that the people call them freedom fighters and look unto them like leaders.
And Bolero from the UK says, what about rebel governments in Africa? What do you think they should be doing? Most African governments, in my opinion, are rebel governments.
And Pak Tekum from Mozambique says, may he rest in peace. Now peace may finally return to the country. Also seemed like an obstruction to peace.
Thank you for those comments, and keep them coming on our DW Africa Facebook page. Now moving on, Germany's Foreign Minister Heiko Maas has just concluded his first visit to Africa. Maas promised that his country would not neglect Africa despite the many crises facing the world at the moment. He said Berlin remains committed to expanding cooperation, especially in the areas of security and economy.
The foreign minister visited Ethiopia and Tanzania, which both maintain close historical and developmental ties with Germany. I talked to Ludka Shadamowski, DW's head of Amharic Department, who is accompanying the minister. He starts by telling us the key sticking issues in Maas' visit to Africa.
Both home to very important Pan-African organizations, obviously the African Union in Ethiopia and Addis Ababa, and the East African Commission and the African Court on Human and People's Rights in Arusha, Tanzania. And during his visit and also during his discussions with both the media and also local politicians, he has stressed the need for multilateral engagement at a time when a lot of countries around the world seem to be pulling out of multilateral policy mechanisms. The message he sent, and he said this in his press conference at the African Union in Addis Ababa, he said, while the world seemed to be moving towards looking more at Syria, at Iran, at the US, Germany will not forget its African partners.
Many will look at it a little bit skeptical because there was a lot of hype last year about Germany-African investment plans. Why has this faded?
Yes, some political analysts we have been speaking to before he traveled to Africa said it was probably a bit too much Africa last year. So people are sort of exhausted. There were many, many initiatives, compacts for Africa, Marshall Plan. I think, again, this very early date of his travel to Africa, he sort of tried to ride the wave, as it were, and stretch the Africa as a topic into 2018.
It's not the first time a German foreign minister is visiting African countries. Is there anything new he has brought on the table this time round?
He seemed very passionate about justice, international justice, and international justice in Africa. I mean, mind you, Heiko Maas is a former German minister of justice. He's a lawyer himself. I can see him supporting this issue of international justice in Africa very strongly.
DW's Ludger Shadomski in Arusha.
Now, from foreign policy, let's now talk politics. Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF today unveiled its party manifesto ahead of the general election this year. President Emmerson Mnangagwa is hoping to convince Zimbabwean voters that he can do a better job by improving their lives.
But ZANU-PF's chance of success is threatened by infighting, which started as a result of a succession battle between former First Lady Grace Mugabe and the incumbent president. Privilege Mushaniri was present during the manifesto launch and sent us this report.
Victory is what Zimbabwe's ruling party ZANU-PF is predicting. Emmerson Mnangagwa, who took over from long-time ruler Robert Mugabe, says his party carries the hope of Zimbabwe.
Ours is a call to be servants of the people. Let us thrive to go out there to win the hearts and the minds of the people for them to vote for our party. You cannot force people to vote for you, but we can persuade people to vote for us.
ZANU-PF hopes to maintain power after ruling for 38 years since independence from Great Britain. This may not be an easy task to win an electorate that is hungry for transformation. Many, particularly young people who in the 2018 elections are the majority of registered voters, are hoping for nothing but jobs and a functioning economy. Political analyst Alexander Rusero predicts a ZANU-PF victory despite the chaos which affected the party's primary elections last weekend.
ZANU-PF is likely to win. Whatever is happening is well choreographed. I don't think what happened in November was an accident of history. It's only unfortunate that by storming in the streets last year, people gave ZANU-PF another lifeline. ZANU had exploded in November. It was a party issue, a party rebelling against their president, but the opposition and the generality of the people were made to believe that it was a revolution.
The Zimbabwe 2018 elections, whose date is yet to be announced, will be crucial for the country to be accepted into the international community. The country's elections have over the years been controversial with allegations of rigging by the ruling party. Hopes are that this will be a thing of the past.
Privilege Mushaniri in Harare.
And Zipporah, we're getting a lot of comments on our Facebook page with people questioning, or rather sending questions. Chrisan Fusi says, why are you not reporting about Cameroons? Well, Chrisan, just hang in there. We will be in Cameroon just right after this.
You are listening to Africa Link live from Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Don't forget, we are also live streaming this show on Facebook, so do join us on DW Africa page and let your voice be heard.
Still to come, who was Josina Machel, the first wife of late Mozambican President Samora Machel?
In 1967, Frelimo offered her a scholarship to continue her studies in Switzerland. But she rejected the offer, believing the best way to keep track of the war was to be closely involved with it.
Don't miss out on her extraordinary story as part of the African Roots series. But before that, let's head to Cameroon, where the crisis in the southwest Cameroon shows no sign of ending. In the past 3 months, armed separatists who wish to create a state they call Ambazonia have stepped up attacks against government installations by targeting police stations and kidnapping civil servants.
The government refers to the separatists as terrorists, and President Paul Biya has ordered a crackdown. It has become difficult for journalists to work under these conditions, as Adrian Krish found out when he spoke to one reporter from the violence-hit region. To protect his safety, we have chosen not to give his name and also voiced over the interview. Take a listen.
Sincerely, I cannot work. We cannot practice our profession the way it should be ethically. Because the government of Cameroon has put in some very strong repressive measures to make sure journalists don't report stories the way they have to and the way things happen in the ground. I give you an example. Journalists are restricted from going to war-torn areas where this crisis has really taken its devilish end. Journalists who even attempt to go there are being arrested. Two journalists were arrested recently in Kwakwa. Kwakwa is a village in Meme Division of the Southwest Region that has been highly hit by the crisis. I remember in March I reported a story of the minister delegate at the presidency in charge of defense. He visited some war-torn parts. I reported that his convoy was attacked. And unfortunately, I was called up at the governor's office to tell them when I got there and how I did get my information. And I should give them my source and all of that. I don't want to tell you how bad I was treated.
But what do you mean they didn't treat you humanly?
I was put in the bunkers in the office of the governor, and they brought me in and told me if I don't give it, I would be sent to the main prison where I would be put in solitary condition. I still did not give them the information. I was given two hefty slaps by the person interrogating me, but still I did not give them any information. When it was getting to 6 p.m., I was told to return home, but my ID card was taken away from me, so I could not leave.
For you as a journalist, is the pressure also coming from the other side, also not only from the government but also from the separatist side?
Yes, a lot of pressure is coming from the separatists. I should tell you, though, that the separatists have been very collaborative, but they have also been threatening journalists. We have many journalists who have also decided to be quiet, especially in war-torn areas like in Konye, Nguti, Kwakwa. In those areas, journalists don't even practice again. They just live like ordinary people because they don't report. If you report in such areas, you can easily be targeted and killed. That is how bad the situation has become.
An anonymous Cameroonian journalist talking to DW's Adrian Krish.
And of course, we have got lots of feedback on that on our Facebook Live. And Eric Njobos says thousands are being killed in Anglophone Cameroon and the international community is mute. Families now live in bushes and still they are saying nothing.
And commenting live on Facebook, Roosevelt Ndum says the earlier the international community engages in the escalating crisis in Cameroon, the better.
Yeah, so of course there's lots of feedback here as well. Fombat in the UK says some journalists are government agents, making it difficult for people to differentiate which journalists are doing a real job.
So keep those comments coming on our Facebook page and we'll read them whenever we can.
DW, African Roots.
Does the name Josina Machel ring any bells? Well, she is an important figure in the history of Mozambique. A freedom fighter who took up arms against Portuguese rule, Machel inspired many other women and men to go to war.
Josina Machel, the first wife of late Mozambican leader Samora Machel, never lived to see an independent Mozambique. But her country still remembers her by celebrating Women's Day on the date of her death. This report by Gloria Souza is now presented by Isaac Mugabe.
Even the sound of heavy gunfire did not discourage Josina Machel from joining Mozambique's Liberation War. born Josina Abiatal Mutemba, Josina Machel was encouraged by her family to go to school. This was unusual for an African woman born in 1945. Her parents even supported her move to the capital, Maputo, where she attended secondary school. There, she became politically active in clandestine student groups. She became an underground member of the Frelimo independence movement and decided to join the liberation war against the Portuguese. It took two attempts before she managed to reach Frelimo headquarters in Tanzania, a 3,500-kilometer journey. Machel was just one of the many who fled Mozambique at the time, stresses Egidio Vaz, a Mozambican historian.
The escape of Josina and so many others to engage in the liberation war was not something unique. I think that anyone living under those political, social, and economic conditions felt they had to do something. Each generation faces a challenge, and Josina and her generation understood that they were ready, proceeding with national liberation.
What made Machel different, though, was her absolute dedication to the war of liberation. This is according to Professor Isabel Casimiro from Mozambique's University Eduardo Mondlane.
When she joined Frelimo in 1965, she took part during training with a women's detachment. In 1967, Frelimo offered her a scholarship to continue her studies in Switzerland. But she rejected the offer, believing the best way to keep track of the war was to be closely involved with it.
Machel also strongly believed that women could play a role in the liberation war. She became the driving force behind Frelimo's women's detachment, a unit where women undertook combat training and political education. She rose through the Frelimo ranks, becoming head of Frelimo's Department of Social Affairs in 1969. At the time, she was only 24 years old. During a speech in Mozambican liberated zones, Josina Machel asked mothers to let their children go to study in Frelimo's education centers.
Frelimo has a great responsibility upon the education of these children because we know they will continue our fight. These children study not for them or their moms, but to serve the country development in this moment of fight and also after the independence.
Shortly afterwards, Josina Machel became sick and her health rapidly deteriorated, but she kept on tirelessly working to build a new society, says Mozambican historian Egidio Vaz.
I were to define Josina, it would be through work, selfless work. It wasn't about what she could get out of it, but rather about the people, saving lives and building a society that is unified, that has solidarity, that promotes mutual help.
In 1969, Josina married Samora Machel, who went on to become the first president of an independent Mozambique in 1975. The couple had a son and named him Samito. But Josina never lived to see her country liberated from the Portuguese. She died in hospital in Tanzania in 1971 from an undisclosed illness. The date of Josina Machel's death, the 7th of April, is celebrated as the Women's Day in Mozambique.
And that report was written by Gloria Souza. African Roots is a project realized in cooperation with the Gerda Henkel Foundation. And you can find videos of more African figures who shaped the continent by visiting dw.com/Africa.
So make sure you go there. And of course, we are revisiting our first story, our story on Cameroon, about the condition of journalists there who are working in difficult conditions.
Yeah, that's right, Zipporah. And people are commenting on that on Facebook page. Roosevelt again, Ndum, saying, how long will the UN keep silencing the senseless war on English minority southern Cameroon? Thousands killed, displaced, live in bushes, people burnt in their houses by Biya's army.
Jude from Cameroon says it's a common practice here in for the rogue regime in power to violate the rights of freedom of speech and expression. And he goes on to say they have intensified their crackdown on journalists now, especially due to the current ongoing Anglophone separatist crisis.
And of course, just neighboring Nigeria, there's also the Biafran crisis. And we have Stephen Osisioma, who says the Biafran need referendum. This is only what we need. But the international community keep mute on the killings by the Nigerian government. So there are a lot of people who are agitating for either the Biafra or Amazonia independence, as they call it.
Yeah, you're right. Of course, there's lots of happenings going on there, but we are sure we will give you all the updates as soon as we get them here.
Right, now moving on to sports. World Soccer governing body FIFA proposal to stage a new mini World Cup every 2 years has been sparking lots of reactions worldwide. While many fear it will devalue its flagship World Cup, others say it would overcomplicate international football.
With us in the studio is Chuck Penfold from our sports desk. To start off, Chuck, what do you think of this move?
They got to stop smoking the drapes, I would almost say. I mean, everybody says there's too much football these days, especially for the top players in Europe who play Champions League or Europa League. They play their own leagues. They play their cups. Then every 2 years they play a major international competition, either the European Championship or the World Cup. Last year we had the Confederations Cup. Then we had, I think, under 21. These players are playing too much football. There's more football than I want to watch at this point. And if this plan, this mini World Cup plan, as I understand it, were to actually be implemented, we'd basically have a semi or major tournament every summer. They want to start it in 2021. The year after, we would have the World Cup 2022 in Qatar. Then they would have it again in 2023. Then we'd have the European Championship in 2024. Then another one of these mini World Cups in 2025, World Cup in 2026.
Okay, that sounds
it would never
like,
stop.
Yeah.
So I just think it's... Now, they think they're going to make a lot of money from it. That's why they want to do it. But I think it's too much.
Okay, Chuck, I got you on that. Now, let's talk now about athletics, because South Africa is angry about new athletics rules, which are prescribing maximum testosterone levels following the question of their Olympic 800 meters champion, Caster Semenya. Do you think their anger is justified?
It's not as clear cut as something like doping, you know, because these are apparently her natural testosterone levels. It's not something that she's taking in. Apparently, the plan is for these athletes who have these high natural testosterone levels to have to take some kind of medication or substance to lower that before they compete in these events. It's a really interesting issue, but it's sort of beyond me. I think you've got to get a scientist or somebody in here.
Next time I'll get a scientist. Okay. Now, let's talk about football. And we know the UEFA football final spots have been sealed after last night, which saw Arsenal hopes dashed. What does this mean for Arsene Wenger?
It means he's going to end his career without a European title. He won several domestic titles in England. He's credited with really reforming football in Britain in a lot of ways. And when he came along over 20 years ago, he really revolutionized the way players, in terms of nutrition and training and all kinds of things. He was like a breath of fresh air in Britain for a long time, brought a lot of success to Arsenal. Last few years, it sort of stagnated. We're reading that the players at Arsenal really wanted to get him into the final and really, you know, get him the Europa League trophy, because that would have been his first European trophy. They played well, but they just didn't get the result. So it's a disappointment for him, given the track record of Arsenal over the past few years. They've been okay, but they haven't had quite enough to get over the line for the big games and titles. So, yeah, it's a bit of a disappointment, but he still had a great career.
That is Chuck Penfold from DW Sports Desk.
Now, Zipporah, leaving sports aside, 200 years ago, a man who would change the world was born in Germany. His name is Karl Marx, and his economic theories became unchallenged doctrine in many countries in the world, including the African continent. Somalia were among these considered Marxist states, and even Tanzania's constitution has references to Marxist theories. From what we know today, is it possible to say whether Karl Marx's analysis of capitalism and his explanations of the economic machine is basically either correct or incorrect? We asked you on Facebook, and one WhatsApp user from Germany says, very incorrect. So you're saying that this stone that in hand does not exist? That's my imagination. His theories led to cruelty, suffering, and destitution in the world.
And Patrick Magnus says he was right all along. Communism trumps individualism.
Well, thank you very much for your comments today. And as always, we appreciate you visiting our webpage, DW Africa, and also dw.com/Africa for more stories on the continent. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And I'm Zipora Nyambura. Bye for now.